This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, could we someday see wind turbines in Morrow Bay?
These things are as big as skyscrapers. You're not going to drive your 21-foot boat through there and go catch rockfish. Are you out of your mind?
And the city manager of San Luis Obispo compares the work he does with team cycling.
Part of my job is to elevate my team, figure out who's the sprinter, who's the hill climber, who's the overall all-rounder, and then use those skills.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 12th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. In our first installment of a 12-part series on farm workers in Santa Barbara County, we're exploring the history of farm workers' rights in California and how that history affects people here on the Central Coast. Here's KCBX's Francisco Martinez.
You can't talk about farm workers in this country without first talking about Cesar Chavez.
All my life, I have been driven by one dream, one goal, one vision: to overthrow a farm labor system in this nation that treats farm workers as if they were not important human beings.
That's Chavez in a 1984 speech to the Commonwealth Club of California. We have a holiday in this state named after him. And following President Biden's inauguration, Chavez's son Paul learned that a bust of his father would be placed in the Oval Office. In an interview with NBC's Los Angeles affiliate, Paul Chavez said he couldn't believe it.
We were just as surprised as everyone when we saw the place that they had placed it.
To be placed in the president's highest office makes sense when you look at Chavez's track record on paper and how his efforts have played a role in recent American history. The rise of the United Farm Workers, they're organizing a series of strikes that brought farm workers to national attention, and it's bringing forth the empowerment of Latinx Americans in the United States. Chavez's advocacy efforts culminated in 1975, when the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. That legislation was instrumental because it gave farm workers collective bargaining rights. It was the first time any state gave its farm workers the right to do so.
And Jerry Brown was instrumental in working closely with UFW and closely with Cesar Chavez. And he actually still regards that as maybe his greatest accomplishment in public life. So the full force of the state was behind farm worker rights at that point.
That's Matt Garcia. He's a professor at Dartmouth College in both the History Department and Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies Department.
Most of my career has been about telling the story of agricultural labor history in California.
Garcia has written books on citrus workers, the United Farm Workers, and their role in the greater farm workers movement, and is currently writing a book about the United Fruit Company, their predecessor to Chiquita. The lead-up to the 1975 Act had been brewing for years, so we need to jump back to the 1930s. His farm workers had found it difficult to make a living wage or have clean and sanitary homes, according to Garcia.
And that stemmed in part from their exclusion in the National Labor Relations Act, known as the Wagner Act of 1935, where they were denied collective bargaining rights while other lines of work were granted those rights.
Then you fast forward a few years later to the Bracero program, which saw the U.S. bring in temporary workers from Mexico, beginning in the 1940s. While the Bracero program was promoted to Mexican workers as a way to contribute to war efforts, Garcia says many of these workers came after World War II.
And they were used in many ways to hold down wages because they could always be sent back to Mexico. They worked under the threat of being returned at any time. And so their impermanence, their temporariness, undercut the ability to create those unions that would give them power in the field and power over their lives.
It's these conditions that prompted Chavez, Dolores Huerta, and Gilbert Padilla to begin organizing farm workers and help end the Bracero program in the 60s.
The growers were not going to acquiesce so easily, and so it took a five-year boycott before collective bargaining rights were reached in 1970, and then eventually were codified in the Agricultural Labor Relations Act of 1975.
Those 5 years of striking between 1965 and 1970, known as the Delano Grape Strikes, were pivotal, especially in making the broader community aware of farm worker issues, and led to boycotts of the grape industry. But when the Agricultural Labor Relations Act in California was signed, advancements for farm workers petered out. While farm workers have seen some advancements in their rights and activists continue to fight for these rights, it hasn't been the same since Chavez. Garcia points out a multitude of reasons, one of which is the partisan nature of the Agricultural Labor Relations Board created by the Act, where the governor could appoint persons to the board.
And so if the governor changed, and the governor did change, to a Republican that was hostile to unions, then that body would then no longer be favorable to farm worker rights.
Another reason? Garcia says Chavez moved away from farm worker rights, focusing more on poverty issues. Garcia says Chavez became invested in creating an intentional community,
where he was interested in growing food and really kind of emulating another intentional community that was called Synanon.
More bluntly,
Caesar took his eye off the ball.
So, now what? Well, over the course of the next 11 weeks, I'll try to help answer that question. We're going to explore farm workers in our community along the Central Coast. We're going to explore the issues that exist and the people behind it all. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
This report is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. Now, we're going to take a look at redistricting on the Central Coast and some of the challenges being faced. KCBX's Benjamin Perper has more.
Redistricting is the process of redrawing district boundaries. It affects who represents us in government, where we go to school, and more. States, counties, and other entities like school districts go through this process based on census data, demographic information that comes from the census, which happens every 10 years. In San Luis Obispo County, district lines are mostly drawn by county staff and then ultimately approved by the Board of Supervisors.
Those lines are drawn, and those are the districts for the next 10 years. So it's important for people to pay attention and be as involved as they'd like to be.
That's Julie Rodewald. She's the Voter Service Director for SLO County's League of Women Voters. She's also a former clerk recorder for the county. The county is getting the census data about 5 months late, and the whole process, including extensive public input hearings, has to be done by the end of this year. Kristen Erickson is an analyst for SLO County's administrative office.
Yeah, we should have had data in April. So obviously, now that we're going to be getting it at the end of September, that puts us under an extraordinary time crunch.
Erickson says because COVID-19 delayed the 2020 census data, the county's going to have to fit a lot of public hearings in just a few months.
And I think it's going to be really difficult for staff who are tasked with redrawing the maps and trying to incorporate all the public input we're going to be gathering. It's going to be challenging for our board, who are not going to have a ton of time to make decisions and provide their input on the maps that we do draw. We are basically going to have to hold, I think, 4 hearings in between the end of October and the end of November.
Julie Rodewald says besides the congressional and supervisorial districts, there are more than a dozen entities, including cities, school districts, and special districts, that are going through redistricting in SLO County.
So those lines need to be in place by like very early December, because that's when the signature in lieu period starts for candidates to start collecting signatures to waive their filing fees. So, and that applies for Assembly, Senate, State Board of Equalization, Congress as well. So there's a really, really tight timeline. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens.
Neil Fornaciari is a commissioner with the California Independent Redistricting Commission, which draws the congressional lines for the state. That in turn determines who gets elected to the House of Representatives and where. Fornaciari says the commission has had to do everything virtually until now, which has made his and other commissioners' jobs more difficult.
Now, with the lifting of the COVID restrictions, we're going to be able to begin to get together, which we're all looking forward to. And the opportunity to go out and see California, hold public meetings in person, and get to hear from Californians in person, which we're really looking forward to.
Fornaciari says the CIRC is holding public input meetings on redistricting and encourages all Californians to participate.
And so I encourage, you know, all the people of California to sign up for a slot. You don't have to sign up for a slot. You can get an appointment, or you can call in and provide your input.
The CIRC is looking for information on communities of interest, areas with shared interests or features like demographics and geography.
You can go to our website, wedrawthelinesca.org, to get more information on signing up and information on, you know, what we're looking for in community of interest input.
To participate in SLO County's redistricting process by submitting public comment or a proposed community of interest, you can call 805-781-1085 or email redistricting@coslo.ca.gov. Now we're going to take a look at the redistricting process in the city and county of Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara City and County both have independent redistricting commissions made up of citizens, or sometimes judges. They get input from the public before drawing maps, independent of elected leaders who might want the maps drawn to benefit them. Most counties in California don't have independent commissions. The majority follow the more traditional model, where the Board of Supervisors is in charge of approving new district lines. Santa Barbara City's commission is made up of three retired judges who don't reside in Santa Barbara County to minimize bias. They're tasked with dividing the city up into six electoral districts. Rebecca Bjork, Assistant City Administrator for Santa Barbara, says the judge's main job is to get public input and make sure the districts are drawn fairly.
We are very interested in making sure that the public knows this is going on, making sure we have a very robust outreach plan and are able to reach all of our public so everyone has a chance to be heard, and so that we understand the interests of all of our residents in drawing these district boundaries so that we can get good representation in our governmental processes.
The city's independent redistricting commission has meeting agendas and schedules posted at santabarbara.ca.gov, and residents can provide public comment at those meetings. In 2018, Santa Barbara County voters approved Measure G, which formed an 11-member independent redistricting commission for the county. To be selected as a member of the commission, there are several qualifications you have to meet. At minimum, you must be a resident of the county, be a registered voter, have not changed political parties in the last 5 years, and have voted in Santa Barbara County in at least one of the last three statewide elections. Santa Barbara County is only one of a few counties in the state, including Los Angeles and San Diego, to have a redistricting commission.
So, we're still plowing some new ground.
That's Commission Chairman Glenn Morris, who's also President and CEO of the Santa Maria Valley Chamber of Commerce. He says voters approved the independent commission to more fairly represent everyone in the county.
I'm sure this is the case in many counties, right? That there are parts of the county that don't feel as connected to the power systems and structures as others, and, you know, that feel like maybe they're not properly represented.
Morris says in recent years, even counties with a more traditional model of having the Board of Supervisors decide district lines have introduced steps to make their process more inclusive. But
the commission, I think, takes it a step further and not only allows for and encourages that kind of interaction on the, you know, kind of the sausage making side of the equation, but it also puts a group of citizens, non-elected citizens, in the decision making role. And so, you know, now it's not just citizens trying to convince elected officials to change a certain decision, but it's a group of citizens that will actually make the determination.
Morris says this model allows for more citizen engagement and general credibility.
So turning it over to the citizens is probably more work, but I think in the end, people will feel like there's more, you know, credibility in the outcome, right? Whatever we end up doing, somebody's going to think we missed, right? Some people are going to love the outcome. Some people are going to hate it. But I think that at a minimum, the hope is that people feel like they at least had a chance to have, to say their piece and to be heard and considered.
Morris says time will tell if the data, in this case, the number of citizens who get involved in the redistricting process, back up his claims about the value of an independent commission.
The real proof of the concept is going to come really over the next, I would say, 6 months, as we now really turn to talking about what are the communities of interest, where should the lines be drawn, who wants to be in districts with who and who doesn't.
You can see the commission's upcoming meetings at drawsantabarbaracounty.org. And now we're looking at the differences between the two different redistricting models that San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County follow. But to try to compare the effectiveness of the two models, we first have to look at redistricting at the state level. Michael Latner is a professor of political science at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo who studies redistricting and gerrymandering, which is when elected officials draw districts designed to favor a political party or group.
At the state level, we've seen this in Wisconsin and Ohio, where a majority of voters support one party, but the party in power maintains its seat majority due to gerrymandering. So it's a very real and a very pervasive problem. And frankly, it contributes to a lot of the political problems that we're seeing today.
Ladner has a book coming out in August that examines redistricting in all 50 states. He says states like California, which has an independent redistricting commission, are less gerrymandered because of those independent bodies.
And indeed, we found that compared to either partisan maps drawn by legislatures and maps drawn by courts or other entities that that occasionally draw maps as a result of litigation and other factors, we found that in both cases, independent commissions did a better job at adopting unbiased maps. And I think part of that has to do with citizens and the involvement of citizens in the process.
This contrast between independent commissions and elected official-led redistricting processes is playing out here on the Central Coast. I asked Latner if he thinks Santa Barbara County's independent commission means it's less partisan and engages citizens more than the traditional model.
Yeah, there's really no question whether it does or it doesn't. Frankly, San Luis Obispo County's process is about the worst process you could design. And the idea that we're still allowing legislators to draw their own districts is rather absurd.
But Kristen Erickson, an analyst for SLO County's administrative office, says their system is designed to minimize politics in the redistricting process.
Obviously, this changes who's representing who for the next 10 years. And in that sense, it's just inherently political. However, our process is designed to take the politics out of the actual drawing of the maps. We're using county staff, and it's a nonpartisan process.
Erickson says that having the county staff work on redrawing the lines makes the potential for gerrymandering less likely to happen.
That's the idea behind both using a staff model. County staff are trained to not be partisan in our activities, but also in the fact that we are adhering to the Fair Maps Act, which is by its nature designed to try to pull the politics out of the decision-making process.
Still, Latner says the Board of Supervisors ultimately votes to adopt or reject the new lines, even if they're drawn by county staff with public input in mind.
Yeah, well, and what you're doing is you're allowing whichever, you're allowing the majority, in this case, a close majority, right, a 3-2 Republican majority in the County Board of Supervisors, you're allowing them to entrench themselves in power. And this happened in jurisdiction across jurisdiction. You have a bare majority that controls the process, and in controlling the process, they end up creating a system that entrenches them in power, which protects them from and insulates them from public accountability.
Latner says he feels independent commissions should be more widespread as a way to prevent gerrymandering.
It is a system that has proved quite effective in reducing bias in districting plans, and we actually are a model for the rest of the country.
You can submit your own maps or comments to Santa Barbara County's Independent Redistricting Commission at drawsantabarbaracounty.org. You can also find their meeting schedule there. You can do the same with SLO County at slocounty.ca.gov/redistricting. For KCBX News, I'm Benjamin Perper.
And now, let's take a look at the possibility of wind turbines in Morro Bay.
Morro Bay is a small fishing village of roughly 10,000 people, named after an ancient volcanic mound that stands like a giant at the tip of the harbor. Fishermen pass by that rock each day, and they're about to get a much taller neighbor, wind turbines.
These things are as big as skyscrapers. You're not going to drive your 21-foot boat through there and go catch rockfish. Are you out of your mind?
Chris Pavone has been fishing in the area for 7 years, along with his wife and 5 kids. He's worried about what's on track to become the first offshore wind farm on the West Coast. Approved by the Biden administration, the project will bring roughly 200 floating turbines into the open ocean near Morro Bay. It's a huge leap towards California's goal of 100% clean electric power by 2045. And though it's got local fishermen worried about their livelihood, this wind farm is coming, whether they like it or not. So how can these two industries coexist out at sea? KCRW's Catherine Barnes reports.
Stroll down the Embarcadero in Morro Bay, and you'll see restaurants like the Dutchman's Seafood House, Giovanni's Fish Market, and Grassy Bar Oyster Company. And if you're lucky, you'll get to meet one of the fishermen who brought that seafood ashore, like Chris Pavone, who you just heard from.
I've been surfing and spearfishing in California my whole life, so I love the ocean, everything about it. I don't ever want to be away from it.
He's among roughly 120 fishermen who trap, troll, and drop lines off Morro Bay and Avila Beach. He's used to having the ocean more or less to himself, but soon he'll have to contend with these turbines. They'll be tall, taller than the Seattle Space Needle, and visible, kinda. They won't be in your face like the ones you've seen off the highway near Joshua Tree. 17 miles off the coast, they'll look like faint lines poking out of the horizon. And they'll be sitting in deeper waters than turbines have ever known. We're talking thousands of feet. Walt Musiel is the offshore lead at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. He studies future technologies in the offshore wind industry. And he says these skyscrapers will be floating rather than fixed to the seafloor.
So basically, it's the same wind turbine on top. From the surface, you might not even know that it's floating, but it's suspended or supported by a buoyant foundation, and it's moored with cables to the bottom with anchors.
The project is expected to take up 399 square miles of ocean land, an area more than twice the size of Lake Tahoe.
And that's enough area to create the beginnings, at least, of a critical mass for an industry in California. And if you combine that with what's happening on the North Coast, then California can think about having offshore wind become a significant contributor to its zero carbon policies.
He's referring to another project that got the green light off Humboldt County. The need for this energy becomes even more important when you factor in nearby Diablo Canyon, the last nuclear power plant in California and a major energy supplier for the state. It's getting decommissioned, but this wind farm will more than replace the electricity Diablo was supplying California, enough to power about a million homes.
The transition away from nuclear energy is a big impact to our region.
Melissa James is the CEO of a local economic action coalition called REACH. She says there's no reason why nuclear power workers can't be trained to become wind power workers.
So it's about 1,500 direct jobs and 3,000 contracted jobs that are going to shift. And so we have an energy workforce that will be willing and ready and able to move into and support the growth of this new industry on the Central Coast.
A recent Cal Poly study found this wind farm would generate at least 650 jobs and more than $250 million in annual economic impacts. But back to the fishermen. You may be wondering, why can't they just fish in and around the turbines so everyone's happy? Because since these turbines are floating, you've got mooring lines, cables, and live electrical wires draped underwater between each platform. It's too risky for a fisherman to be putt-putting around, dropping nets, traps, and fishing lines. And who knows if the fish will even stick around. Pavone says the 400-square-mile section will become yet another place he can't fish, in addition to dozens of marine protected areas out of bounds for fishermen.
It's already, if you saw a map of where you can't fish, it's like a mosaic on the ocean. You're like, whoa, so you have to go around here and go over there. Yeah, it's crazy. Right now, for me to make a really good day and make money, I'm driving all the way down to Prisma, you know, an hour, hour and a half in my boat.
He worries more displacement will lead to more fuel costs, fewer fish brought to market, and ultimately, more people dissuaded from becoming fishermen at all. And it's not just the wind farm itself. There's also talk of a new deep-sea port going in along the Central Coast to transport and service these turbines. It'll add more local jobs, but fishermen like Pavone say it'll disturb the underwater habitat.
I know the fish would be scared and they would move. So when they show up here with their big boats and their rumbling engines and their sonar pinging the bottom and trenching the bottom, that screws everything up, sometimes for years.
The project will likely get split into three parcels and leased to three different wind developers. So far, only one prospective developer has met with the fishing industry and addressed these impacts. It's called Castle Wind, and Ala Weinstein is the CEO.
We'll create a fund for the benefit of the fishermen. And effectively, it becomes a revenue-sharing agreement.
In other words, if her company should win the bid for a lease, she's prepared to compensate each individual fisherman and set a pot of money aside for them to use at their discretion.
Improving safety of the boats, improving boats, scholarships, training, whatever they feel is required, including some infrastructure repairs.
Pavone and the other fishermen are happy with this agreement. But it's only one developer who hasn't even won the bid for a lease yet. The federal government is expected to open the lease auction next year, and the turbines will position the Central Coast to lead the country in renewable energy. they'll join local solar farms and what could become the world's largest lithium battery. But that's a story for another day. In the meantime, fishermen like Pavone are enjoying their quiet harbor while they can.
And this is a special place.
And making sure they keep their seat at the table when construction begins.
That was KCRW's Catherine Barnes. And for KCBX News, I'm Benjamin Perper.
Healthy People, Healthy Trails is a community initiative in Santa Barbara County. It began 5 years ago when Sansom Clinic, the Trails Council, and the National Park Service joined together to promote health and well-being through the use and enjoyment of nature. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with steering committee member Gabby Labrania about how the program has grown.
This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas. Today we're talking about Healthy People, Healthy Trails. Thank you very much, Gabby, for being here with me today. And why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us about Healthy People, Healthy Trails.
Sure. So I'm so happy to be speaking with you. Thank you so much for inviting Healthy People, Healthy Trails onto your program. So my name is Gabby Labrania. I'm the Senior Health Promotion Educator with SunCal Health. And SunCal Health is the Medi-Cal managed care health insurance plan for both Santa Barbara County and San Luis Obispo County. And so I oversee and coordinate all of our health promotion programs, our health education services, and things like that. And part of what I do is also collaborate with the community on programs and initiatives that have goals of improving the health of our community members, because so many of our community members are actually SunCal Health members. So there's a lot of overlap. And so Healthy People, Healthy Trails is a community initiative with a dynamic group of community partners ranging from, Parks and Rec to land use organizations to healthcare providers. And the goal of Healthy People, Healthy Trails is really to just help folks get active and connect people to walks and paths in their own neighborhoods that are easy to access and that are approachable, and to just really encourage people to get moving outside.
The program launched about 5 years ago. How did the idea grow and develop into what it is today?
Yes. So we have been at this for about 5 years, and we are a small but determined bunch of folks who get together once a month, and it's really grown from our original idea, which was to offer maps to, like I said, easy to access and easy to use paths and trails in neighborhoods or, in open spaces, which we still do. And that's what we call our trail guide. And that's available to the community at large. It's on our website. And there's maps for locations all over Santa Barbara County. Our second component is partnering with healthcare providers. And this is something that we continuously work to grow in this area. And we've created what we call a prescription for outdoor activity. And it's a resource that we provide to the healthcare community where providers, whatever type of healthcare provider or dietitian or, what have you, can actually prescribe outdoor activity to their patients who they feel would benefit from an increased amount of physical activity. And, that's most of us. So it's a really useful tool. Some of our local providers really enjoy using it. We are trying actively to get more healthcare providers on board and collaborating with us.
There's actually a prescription pad for doctors to use when suggesting this idea to their patients. Is it merely a fun way to pass on the information and the trail guides and that kind of thing? Or is there something more medical to it?
It's sort of the former. It's either a print copy, or some providers have actually built it into their EHR system, their electronic health record. So if a patient of theirs is sort of like flagged for being a candidate for increasing physical activity, they've built this into their EHR where then they can print out this prescription. And it's not a formal prescription, but it's sort of an accountability tool. It's something tangible to send with the patient that says, your doctor's name on it, how many minutes that they're encouraging you to get of physical activity, and just it's sort of like a shared decision-making tool.
Can you just briefly go over the health benefits for us of hiking and walking? I mean, I feel like most of us know that getting outside, breathing fresh air, and moving our bodies is good for our health. But this is really a health initiative based on evidence, right? Medical evidence.
Absolutely. So Healthy People, Healthy Trails, one of our like guiding principles is to use evidence-based programs and strategies. And there is so much research that shows that physical activity has an incredible impact on our health and our wellness. And so this is physical health. You know, it can help with managing chronic conditions like diabetes and heart disease and help lower blood pressure and things like that. But there's also so much positive impact to our mental health and things like lowering stress and just improving mental wellness. And I think that after this year that we've had with COVID and, you know, spending so much time indoors and all the stress that has come with that, we've really tried to encourage people to stay active outside while keeping those safety protocols in mind, because there is such a strong, you know, evidence to support the idea that spending time in nature, and, you know, there is even evidence that shows that being in nature and not even really being that active, but just being outside really, really helps with mental health, with all sorts of things. So
this is Beth Thornton, and I'm talking with Gabby LaBragna about Healthy People, Healthy Trails. I noticed on your partner list, the Audubon Society, Parks and Rec, the Sierra Club. It's really a big group of people coming together to kind of promote not only being in the outdoors for exercise, but it seems like an environmental awareness as well.
Absolutely. There's so many different components to this because it is such a multifaceted idea, and the approach that we've taken to it is really trying to pull people in from all sorts of different fields, because it is a very common issue. Spending time and being active outdoors is important for everybody. And so for land use organizations, for Trails Council, for Parks and Rec, and then there's the health side of things. So we really do have a robust network of collaborators. And we've been really, really fortunate to have built this network over the past 5 years.
How does someone get involved in your program?
One way is if your doctor were to prescribe you the outdoor activity, but that's just one side of things. Anyone in the community is more than welcome to use our resources, and they're just right on our website, healthypeoplehealthytrails.org. There's the list of maps for walks in different areas across the county. There's also a calendar of events where we list all of the group walks that are happening in the upcoming weeks. It's a really wonderful resource. I think it's the most comprehensive calendar of group walks and outings in the county, I think. That did sort of get put on hold during COVID, but it is one of the main resources that we offer to the community, and that's free to use right on our website. And then, of course, for, you know, some added inspiration, there's our collaboration with the art community.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the art show currently in San Ynez, about the trails of Santa Barbara County. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So so it's at the Wildling Museum in Solvang, and the exhibit is called Art from the Trail, Exploring the Natural Beauty of Santa Barbara County. We collaborated with the Wildling, and we actually selected a handful of the paintings that are being shown in this exhibit, and we created what we call art and trail cards. And so what we've done is we've taken the art piece and we print that on one side of a postcard, and on the other side, we print a map to the location that the artist was standing or sitting when they painted that piece. So you can see the art piece, and then you can actually go see the inspiration for that piece in real life. So it's a really fun kind of way to get inspired to maybe go do a hike or a walk that you haven't done before. And the art and trail cards are right there at the exhibit. So if you see a particular painting that you're really inspired by, you can grab one of the cards and go and see that space in real life.
You plan to continue to grow the program. What's coming up?
Yeah, so one major thing that's sort of currently happening and will be going on for the next couple of months is our spring and summer challenge. And so this is also open to the community. And we are really just encouraging folks to spend time in nature, especially after coming out of hardest time of sheltering in place and quarantine for COVID. And so this spring challenge is really where community members are able to sign up for free, spend time in nature, be active outdoors, and then just go to the dashboard and enter in their active minutes. And every week we do a weekly drawing of folks that are participating and we give prizes. And so these prizes range from, you know, smaller items like bandanas, all the way up to things like a really nice hiking backpack that's stuffed with goodies. There's some hydro flasks being offered. So it's a fun way to encourage people to get outside during these warm, sunny months and reap the benefits of spending time in nature.
It's called the Spring Challenge, but does it go throughout the summer?
Yes, it does. So it launched in May and it actually goes through October. So the sign up for that is just on healthypeoplehealthytrails.org. It's really easy to manage. You just sign up and then you enter in your active minutes and you're eligible for prizes.
Thank you, Gabby, for sharing this information. And there are trails from Carpinteria to Lompoc.
Yes, you got it. From Carpinteria up through Santa Barbara. There's actually some also in the valley, the San Ynez Valley, through Lompoc, and all the way up to Santa Maria. So it really does span the entire Santa Barbara County.
That was Gabby Labrana from Healthy People, Healthy Trails. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Beth Thornton.
In a recent article in the San Luis Obispo Tribune, meteorologist John Lindsay reports that a serious decline in the sea star population has led to a massive die-off of the kelp forests along the Northern California coastline. KCBX's Sophie Lincoln spoke with Lindsay about the phenomenon and how it might affect the Central Coast.
So can you tell me a little bit about how this decline in sea stars has affected the food chain and what we're seeing now with kelp forests being kind of devoured by sea urchins?
Sure. So it's not that big of an issue along the Central Coast, but certainly off the coast of Northern California. And so what's transpired is there's wasting disease that's really impacted the sea star population. And in turn, without anything to keep the purple sea urchins in check, and you know, they're essentially eating all the kelp forest. And both Macrocystis, which is California giant kelp, and even more so as far as bull kelp, which is Nereocystis. So the purple sea urchins basically will consume everything in sight. I mean, not only Macrocystis and Nereocystis, but all sorts of red, brown, and green algaes. And what's referred to, they'll actually create a urchin barren where the only thing that exists are purple sea urchins, essentially. And they lose a lot of their nutritional value because there's nothing left to eat. And so they'll actually turn to become cannibals. They'll actually eat each other, believe it or not, because there's absolutely total lack of food, which a lot of marine biologists didn't even realize what was occurring. So what caused the wasting disease of these sea stars? A lot of people think that it's the warm water blob. You know, of course, we've seen record-breaking ocean temperatures, especially along our coastline in October of 2015, the average seawater temperatures got up to 67 degrees, which I never thought was really possible. Then a few years later, in Southern California, the Scripps near shore buoy got up to 81.6 degrees, which is another remarkable reading I never thought we would see. And perhaps these warmer than normal seawater temperatures combine with lower pH, which means that the water is becoming more acid due to the absorption of excessive amounts of CO2, that may have been the contributing factor to wasting disease of the sea stars. And in turn, of course, nothing to keep the purple sea urchins in check, which allowed them to basically eat all the kelp forest off the Northern California coastline.
NPR actually did a similar story, which mentions that warmer ocean temperatures also make sea stars more susceptible to diseases.
I mean, that's what we think, Sophie, but who knows for sure. But that's a hypothesis that warmer seawater temperatures and ocean acidification and higher. Another thing, too, is maybe higher swell energy levels. It seems like every couple of years we break the record for lowest atmospheric pressure in the middle of these storms. And consequently, the winds are becoming stronger. And the winds are what basically generates the waves as they blow across the ocean. It's called the fetch. And the stronger the winds, the higher the waves and the longer periods they have. And the longer period waves have more energy, right? And that higher amount of energy may be, you know, basically ripping up these kelp beds to a greater extent. But as far as wasting disease of the sea stars, it's probably related to warmer ocean temperatures and then lower pHs due to the absorption of CO2 in the atmosphere.
This phenomenon is most present in Northern California, but you did mention that it is occurring to an extent in the Monterey Bay area. Do you think it is possible that this phenomenon could happen further down the Central Coast at some point?
Now, what's going on along our reefs, though, because of the southern sea otter, is that what happens is that the sea urchins that are on the periphery of a healthy kelp bed have a lot of nutritional value. And it's so interesting, these sea otters, they have to eat about 24% of their body weight a day to stay alive. And some sea otters specialize in crabs, some sea otters specialize in abalone mollusk. And other sea otters specialize in urchins. And they won't waste their time on the urchins and a baron because, you know, they'll harvest those and there's no nutritional value to them. So what they do is they concentrate on the urchins near a healthy kelp bed and they eat those. And in turn, that keeps that kelp bed from being devoured. And so that's what we're finding along our coastline. The southern sea otters have really helped to keep in check the purple sea urchins. And despite having wasting disease over sea stars, I think, in my humble opinion, that I think a healthy sea otter population will really help to prevent the same sort of 95% reduction in kelp forest off the Northern California coast. And it'll prevent the same thing from happening along our coast. I really believe the healthy sea otter population will go a long ways in controlling the sea urchins.
In your article, you cited a study by the University of Santa Cruz that found that the kelp population has declined by an average of 95% since 2013 in Northern California. What potential damaging effects might this decline in kelp forests have on other marine life or even the economy?
Yeah, I do know that the kelp forest provides a refuge or an ecosystem. The kelp forest ecosystem is amazing with all the different invertebrates and snails. It's remarkable how many creatures live within the kelp forest. It's on a clear day, when if you're lucky enough to go diving on a clear day and you're swimming through the Macrocystis or the Nereocystis, it's literally like swimming through a rainforest. And there's so many varieties of so many different creatures that I would think as the kelp forest in Northern California was reduced by 95%, I just logically think that probably really reduced the diversity of different creatures along the California, Northern California coastline. So it's been a real devastating loss. There's really no way to, I wish there was some way to sugarcoat it, but it's been devastating, not only for, you know, abalone, but for a lot of other different species of creatures that make their home in the kelp forest.
How might other stressors like warmer ocean temperatures, ocean acidification, and higher swell energy levels have also affected this?
Bull kelp, which they say is their primary food source, is basically it's more sensitive to seawater temperatures. As such, bull kelp could be the first notable species of kelp in our area that could be impacted by seawater temperature warming associated with climate change. So none of this is comforting for me, considering the enormous amount of greenhouse gases we keep pumping into our atmosphere.
Do you know of any potential solutions that can be implemented to save the kelp forests?
Sure. So what they're doing up in Northern California is their volunteer divers are going out and they're actually removing sea urchins. And in basically what happens, they just go out there and remove a bunch of sea urchins. You know, the results of that may vary. So what they're doing is they're finding existing kelp forest and they're removing the sea urchins near existing kelp forests in hopes that they'll repopulate the rocky intertidal and the rocky reefs. That's key. If you just go out there and you remove a bunch of sea urchins that happen not to be near a kelp forest or a kelp bed, that really won't help. But they found that removing sea urchins near existing kelp beds have made a big difference. So that's what a lot of volunteers are doing at this point. As the oceans warm, it is of great concern. Changes to the marine ecosystem, long-term monitoring of the kelp. I think that's another thing that one of the foremost experts along the Central Coast, as far as kelp goes, is Scott Camara. And he's a longtime marine biologist. And he told me that something that we should really do in the future is to have long-term monitoring of the kelp beds is crucial. So then they can make educated decisions on what to do next, such as removing sea urchins now near existing kelp beds. And I couldn't agree more.
That was meteorologist John Lindsay speaking with KCBX's Sophie Lincoln. And finally, Working Lunch.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chambers weekly series where we connect with community leaders and get to know the person behind the position. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO of the San Luis Chamber, and we're thrilled you're back here with us for today's conversation with Slow City Manager Derek Johnson. Before coming to San Luis Obispo, Derek served as the Director of Community Development in the city of Capitola and as Santa Barbara County's Director of Long-Range Planning, honing his expertise in infrastructure financing and redevelopment, as well as organizational development and change management. In 2011, Derek and his family made the jump to SLO, where he became the city's community development director, jumping headfirst to updating the general plan. He's also served as the city's finance director and assistant city manager prior to being hired for the top job. Derek, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me today.
In those initial days coming to SLO, did you see something here that ability to help you grow or do the things you wanted to do?
You know, I have this story that I talk about when California was settled by the Spanish, that they picked the prime locations. I mean, where all the missions are, that's where you want to be, whether it's Santa Barbara, San Juan Capistrano, Santa Cruz, and San Luis Obispo. And so it has a lot of the right amenities, water, and you typically a university. It's got a good urban fabric. Got an engaged community. You know, we're the 16th incorporated city out of over 480 cities. So we're one of the earliest cities that was incorporated in the state. We're actually older than the state of California itself, and to some extent. And so, you know, looking at just all of the qualities of SLO, I said, you know, this is where I can come and have an impact and make a difference. Having spent my time in Santa Barbara, and I love Santa Barbara, it's a fabulous community, I quickly realized that part of my job was there, was seemingly at some times to make sure that things did not happen. And I became very frustrated with that and said, you know, we can do better. And at that time, when I arrived in SLO in 2011, there seemed to be impetus to how can we make San Luis Obispo better? And I wanted to be a part of that.
In my own time in local government, I heard a number of different versions of what residents think a city manager does. Maybe you can help set the record straight.
Well, I'll start off with the misconceptions. People think oftentimes that the mayor runs the day-to-day operations of the city. in our form of government here, which is a mayor, council, city manager. The city manager runs the day-to-day operations. The mayor and the council, they make policy and oversee the budget. They, in turn, oversee only two of the city employees, and that's the city attorney and the city manager. I, in turn, hire everyone else. One of the misperceptions, though, is that unlike a CEO in the private sector, which I have done that in my time, in the public sector, when a city manager decides to do something, that's usually the beginning of a conversation. In the private sector, when a CEO decides to do something, that's the end of the conversation, and usually you're headed in the right direction. So oftentimes people, when I tell people what I do, they'll say, oh, you're the planner. Are you the city clerk? So they don't really understand. And when finally I say, hey, I'm the equivalent of a CEO, but for a municipal corporation, that's when people make the connection.
One of those first things that I learned about you was that you were an avid cyclist, and folks might not know that cycling actually is a team sport. Even though the captain is usually the most visible person, the whole team kind of makes the thing run. Do you feel that city manager role is similar to that lead cyclist on a team?
Absolutely. It is one where cycling is a team sport, and it's in, you know, there are properties of being on a cycling team. I tell people cycling is a sport where it's akin to racing at 30 miles an hour, playing chess and holding your breath. And it feels like that. But in the case of being a city manager, your team, your cycling team is your executive team. So your community development director, your police chief, your fire chief, they're all pulling. And so sometimes on a cycling team, sometimes you're at the front of the peloton and sometimes you're at the back. And what people don't know about cycling is that just the mere physics of it is when you're at the front, you're using 30 to 40% more energy than being at the back of the peloton. And we all know we can't be at the front all the time. So part of my job is to elevate my team, figure out who's the sprinter, who's the hill climber, who's the overall all-rounder, and then use those skills. And so part of my job is to, you know, to develop that vision and get people to coalesce around that vision and then develop a plan and then use that team to execute that plan.
You mentioned at the last city council meeting on Tuesday that it had been 476 days since our last in-person council meeting. How did it feel to be back in chambers after such a huge absence?
Yeah, it felt liberating. It was, we have done a lot of work in preparation of making sure the people felt safe, that things went smoothly. It was just so good to see community members. It was good to see people and faces in the crowd, people from the chamber, people who wanted just to come to the podium and talk about issues, to make announcements. You know, there's a lot of people who are talking about, you know, return to quote unquote normalcy and what that looks like. For me, you know, having in-person meetings was one of those benchmarks to start to say, hey, how can we do government? Because government feels like it, you know, some aspect of it, we can do a lot of it virtually. We adapted to doing things virtually, but having it done in person, because local government is closest to the people, it just seems natural for us to have the people's business done out in the open and in person.
Well, and I know that one of the things I'm most proud of the city as an organization, but also as a community, having accomplished in those 476 days was the passage of Measure G, which has already been utilized by the city to help our community recover more quickly and thrive into the future. Is there something that sticks out to you as a particularly proud moment in that time?
You know, Measure G has afforded us the resources to implement a lot of the dreams and vision and the general plan. You mentioned, Jim, early on that when I came here, that was one of the first tasks, was updating the city's vision. We have now projects underway throughout the city that many people see, new housing that's being built under record numbers. And up until Measure G got passed, we did not have the resources to build the infrastructure that was needed. So projects like the Prado Road overpass, rebuilding the police station, rebuilding fire stations, bike transportation, all of that was beyond our capabilities. And now we have the resources to do that. But then COVID came along and we had businesses that were experiencing stresses unlike no other time. So our partnership with the Chamber, with the SLO County Foundation to provide business grants, to provide 5-day turnaround permits for re-tenanting, to building parklets in response to the pandemic. All of that would have been impossible without the community's support in Measure G.
The city really used COVID to think about doing things differently. And given the moment we're in right now, leaders of all types are in positions of having slogged through this long, extremely challenging time. But we're also faced with that real opportunity to rethink what we do and how we do it. What keeps you energized and how do you keep your team motivated after all the work and stress of the pandemic and possibly thinking about new ways of doing this stuff?
Yeah, you know, there's an Emerson quote that I'm probably going to butcher a little bit here, but and it was gendered based when he said it back, but he said, man is not best in his goals, but best in his transitions. Society and the world is going through a transition. Many people liken it to the perhaps the biggest transition that we had in the 20th century, the Industrial Revolution. We're going through another revolution. We don't know what it looks like because we're still in the middle of it. And so through the pandemic, I realized that we could do a lot of work and make decisions and be action-oriented, and that we had the grace to make mistakes and then readjust and adapt. And that's not typically what happens in government. We're so risk-averse. We tend to have lots of process and make sure that we worked out all of the risk before we implement something so we don't get any criticism. And we couldn't afford to do that during an emergency. And so I'm hoping that a lot of the muscle memory we learned towards action and getting things done and building up the trust and confidence that if we don't get it right the first time, that we can pivot and then and make some corrections, that will be the continued relationship that we have with the city.
And I think it is really one of the things I've heard most from the business community, certainly, and others around, that it was nice to see that ability. What are the key areas you'd like to see our community discuss?
I certainly want to look at our continued opportunity for housing. We know that we're producing more housing than we ever have, but we clearly know that it's not enough. I was actually just talking with an architect last night at the farmer's market, and he was talking about one of the new projects that was being built that just was completed, and it's already fully tenanted. So we know that there is a huge demand for housing. My wife works for the local school district. She's trying to hire teachers into our market, and great teachers that they want to bring to our county are unable to find housing. And so we know that that's something that we need to continue to do. And that's going to require us to think differently and take different approaches to how we're looking at development. I'm hoping also that the same thing happens with infrastructure. We made a lot of improvements for bike and ped mobility changes. Some of those didn't work early on, like closing streets. Some worked, like reducing Monterey down to a one lane. And so we're going to need the grace to experiment a little bit more and know that if we make mistakes, that we'll have full intentions of correcting those. I mean, you all know working in the private sector that, you know, some of the best companies in the world, part of your annual performance evaluation is, you know, tell us about your biggest risk and your biggest failure. Because if you're failing, that means you're trying and you're experimenting. And I want to have the ability to do that here at the city as well.
Derek, I just want to say thanks for the amazing work you're doing.
That was the San Luis Obispo City Manager, Derek Johnson, speaking with the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona. If you'd like to keep up with what the city is working on, go to slowcity.org. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.